Welcome to the Breathful Podcast. I'm Adriana Lozada, and today we're going to be talking about shoulder dystocia. If you had or have a baby who is suspected to be big, your provider may have talked about the risk of the shoulders getting stuck and maybe suggested an earlier induction or even a cesarean. But how often do the shoulders get stuck? What are the risks? Does it happen more to big babies? Are there ways to prevent it? And what can you and your provider do if shoulder dystocia does happen? The ever-amazing Rachel Reed has answers. Stay tuned. This episode of Birthful is brought to you by Megan Othling, a fabulous birth doula, childbirth educator, and prenatal and postpartum exercise specialist in Albuquerque, who is all about offering families the information and support they need to make their own empowered pregnancy, birth, and postpartum choices. Learn more at womanofvalorbirth.com. This episode of Birthful is also brought to you by Expectful, an evidence-based guided meditation app created specifically for those trying to conceive, pregnant, or new moms. Learn more and sign up for a free one-month trial at expectful.com/birthful. The Birthful Podcast, talking to maternity pros and new parents to inform your intuition. Hello, mighty parents and parents-to-be. Thank you, as always, for all the love you give this show, your feedback, your messages, your requests, your ratings, your reviews, all the general support. If what you hear is helpful, do make sure you subscribe so you don't miss a thing. And also, please support this podcast by supporting its sponsors, which in this week's case are Megan Othling, Expectful, and Simply Breastfeeding. You can also up your support a notch if you want by becoming an official Birthful Patreon and joining the Birthful community at patreon.com/birthful. As part of the thank you rewards, Birthful patrons get extra content and access to the ad-free versions of the episode. And for today's episode, the extra content includes a very candid conversation with Rachel about our musings on the ARRIVE trial, breech vaginal births, and the way protocols get established in the birthing system. And you might also be asked to be like a toddler and ask why. Quick and important reminder that if you're around 30 weeks of your pregnancy, this is the perfect time for you to start preparing for the actual having a baby part, not just having the birth part. And to do that, I encourage you to go to birthfulcourses.com and sign up for my Thrive with Your Newborn online postpartum preparation classes. This is going to help you get ready, not just for those first few weeks with your newborn and how to take care of them, but also tools on how to deal with the identity change that is coming your way and ways to support your recovery. Do it now before baby arrives. Go to birthfulcourses.com and sign up to get postpartum ready. All right, so today's episode is on shoulder dystocia, which is basically the event of the shoulders getting stuck in the pelvis, usually after the head comes out. It's one of those things that more often than not is brought up by care providers in a very scary way, with the risks being amplified. I find that more often than not, the conversations can evoke anxiety, insecurity, and even guilt in the expectant parents, which can often lead to them making decisions based on those feelings rather than the information or the evidence or their risks and using, you know, the BRAIN acronym. So even though shoulder dystocia is a rare event, this is a sucky and often unnecessary mind space to inhabit during the last few weeks of pregnancy, that like anxiety filled, is it going to happen? Is my baby too big? Shoulder's going to get stuck? It's a lot. Lately, I find that this conversation is coming up way too often not to do a show about it. So here we are. And to guide us through all the data, risks, and options, I have with me today the wonderful Rachel Reed, who is a senior lecturer and discipline leader in midwifery at the University of the Sunshine Coast in Australia. And she's also the author of the amazing blog Midwife Thinking. And if you haven't already, you should include Midwife Thinking in your reading list. Rachel also published the great book in 2018 titled Why Inductions Matter, and the book is very comprehensive, which means it's a quick read. I've linked both her blog and the book in the show notes, so do check those out. All right, shoulder dystocia then. Here we go. Hello, Rachel. It is such a fun delight to have you back on the show.
Thank you. It's lovely to be back.
Yeah, and I do want to make sure listeners know about your blog, which is called Midwife Thinking, because I want to thank you for that blog, because it is such a great fountain of information and a solid research. it always comes up on my feed whenever I search for birthy stuff. And I'm reminded of what amazing work you do. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. I actually started it mostly for myself because I like to have kind of get things into an order so that I can understand them and to use with women that I cared for and with students. So, yeah, I was quite surprised that it took off in the way that it did. But that's good.
Yeah, you do good work. And so aside from the blog, tell us a little bit more of what you do, a little bit more about yourself and how you got into this birth world.
Oh, okay. So I started as a midwife in 2001 in the UK, which is kind of where I'm from, and worked clinically in hospitals, in the community, and in the UK, home birth part of the system, and then moved to Australia and worked clinically as a midwife in Australia, whilst also studying my PhD, and then kind of got into teaching and lecturing, and that's where I am now. I did independent midwifery in Australia so that I could carry on doing continuity of care and home birth, which is not part of the system widespread in Australia. It is in some areas. And now I am a senior lecturer in midwifery, teaching students and speaking at conferences and writing and researching. Which is great because it's all the things that I'm interested in. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, true birth nerd. And I say that in the nicest way because I consider myself one too.
Yes.
Yeah. So this topic, I was so happy when you said yes to talking about shoulder dystocia and big babies. And because those things are, for some reason, I think they pop up in seasons, right? Sometimes you hear all about big babies, big babies, big babies, and then it goes away, and then it's all about, you know, low amniotic fluid, and then that sort of dies down, and then it's back to big baby. So I feel like I'm in a season of big babies right now, and there is so much fear around it, and so it can be scary depending on how you talk about it. So let's break it down. Let's have some facts here of how things happen to help new and expectant parents have an informed decision as to which way they're going to go. So anyway, big babies. Now, let's start with shoulder dystocia. What is shoulder dystocia?
Oh, well, according to the textbooks, shoulder dystocia is the baby's shoulders become stuck and impacted. So the bony part of the baby's shoulders becomes stuck and impacted on the bony part of the woman's pelvis. That's it in a nutshell, which is maybe helpful or maybe not helpful for practitioners and women. But that's the definition.
Well, and I think when people hear the word stuck, that already has some undertones to it, right? And when I was reading your post on shoulder dystocia, something that I found interesting was that it doesn't exclusively relate to the baby's shoulder getting stuck on the mom's pubic bone after, you know, as the head is coming out, which is, frankly, before I went and was reading deeper, I did think that that was the only way because that's kind of the one that everybody focuses on.
Yes, and I think that's largely because there's such a diverse population of care providers that often managing complications are kept very simplistic because it's just too difficult for lots of people to be doing lots of different things. So the focus is on that one type of shoulder dystocia, and all of the management and drills are based on that scenario, which doesn't matter because in the end it will release a shoulder even if it's not stuck there. But it might be a waste of time for a little bit if that's not where the shoulders are stuck. And it's probably the most common form, but really the babies don't come out exactly the same way, like textbooks say they do. So the baby's shoulder can get stuck anywhere within the pelvis, depending on what's happened for that baby and within that pelvis. So it's just a little bit more complex, but in order to keep it simple, that's the definition. And if you do a search on YouTube for the kind of medical, and I've got a link, I've got one on my blog of how it happens, then it's always the baby's shoulder getting stuck behind the pubic bone.
Mm-hmm. So that is shoulder dystocia. So then what is considered a big baby?
Depends who you're asking. And it depends in proportion to the mother, I guess. But by definition, the kind of medical term is macrosomia for big babies. And that's a baby. So I think in kilos in Australia. So that's 4 kilos. But I know that other parts of the world still use the pounds and ounces. So that's 8 pounds, 13 ounces would be considered a big baby, which is interesting because, you know, if I look at the births I've attended over the last few years, most babies are around 4 kilos or bigger.
Right. So I love that you also, when initially answering the question, you said, and it also depends on the mother's, like, big for who? Mm. Is it a teeny, you know, what's the space around that baby? Is it sort of more of a compact shape? Or is there proportionate shape and long torso and such? Number of 4 kilos, 8 pounds, 13 ounces really doesn't address that.
No, and also, you know, for example, I had a baby myself that was 6 pounds, 15 ounces, which is normal, but I think she was actually growth restricted for me. I'm very tall. I've got a long body. I'd previously had a bigger baby, and babies generally get bigger, but she wasn't classified as growth restricted because she was a normal weight. So we need to look at a lot more than, you know, just the weight of the baby. And we've got now healthy women birthing babies. Their smoking has gone down significantly, and that impacts on the size of a baby. So I think prior to smoking rates going down, our ideas about what a normal size baby was influenced by a much higher rate of small babies.
That makes total sense. I never even considered the smoking thing. Are these numbers that we usually manage, the 4 kilos, 8 pounds, 13 ounces, have they taken are they before or after the sort of lessening of smoking in general for pregnant people?
I'm not sure when those figures came out. I know that certainly as a midwife, I haven't seen a lot of excitement around big babies until the last decade, which would correspond with when babies are getting bigger. That's for sure. Babies are definitely getting bigger, but the demographics of the women birthing are getting different. In particular, smoking. We've got well nourished women who grow bigger babies. We've got bigger women who grow bigger babies. So there's a lot of other things going on. So I think focusing on the weight of an individual baby is not helpful without putting that in the context of the woman, and you know what is normal for her, because a over 4 kilo baby is probably normal for a lot of women, and certainly I've noticed with the demographic of women that I've cared for in Australia in home birth is a very select group, I guess, compared to the UK, where I cared for women from very low socioeconomic groups who, you know, weren't as well nourished, weren't as healthy. Often smoked, lots of smoking, and their babies were generally fairly small. And then caring for a group of women in Australia who are well-resourced, who, you know, I guess have the privilege of being able to pay for independent midwifery, their babies were big, mostly 4 kilos and over.
And now, so in terms of big baby and shoulder dystocia, how do those two relate, or do they?
Okay, well, they do. If you look statistically, so for a baby who's 8 pounds, 8 ounces or smaller, then 1% of that group of babies will have a shoulder dystocia. Once you're getting into babies who are 8 pounds, 8 ounces and over, you've got 5%, and it kind of goes up as the baby gets bigger. So there is definitely an increase in shoulder dystocia as the baby gets bigger. However, we've got to remember that research includes women who had abnormal blood glucose levels in pregnancy. And there's a difference between a baby that's just big, genetically big, and a baby who has had high blood glucose levels from their mother that has then increased their own insulin, which then actually makes them lay down fat. So they're not bigger skeleton-wise, but they lay down fat across their shoulders and at the upper part of the body. So they are more likely, you know, if you've had abnormal blood sugars in pregnancy, your baby is more likely to be bigger in a shape that is more likely to get stuck in on the way out. So we've just got to be
careful. And so,
yeah.
Go ahead.
So we've just got to be careful about saying, oh, you know, if babies this size are more likely to get, you know, stuck. It again depends on why are they that size. You know, what else is happening?
Yeah, and also let's go to the first point, which is how that size is even being determined. Mm. How do we know the size of this baby?
So we can measure babies after they're born. That's the only accurate measurement. So the studies that look at shoulder dystocia percentages are looking at what was the weight of the baby after the baby was born. Because beforehand, you know, you've got a 50% chance of being inaccurate just by palpation and measurement. And even an ultrasound.
What was that percentage again?
50%.
50, okay.
50 if you're just palpating, you know, if somebody just got a tape measure and using their hands. And then when you get to ultrasound, which is kind of the best available, and I'm saying that in quotes, you've still got a huge margin of error, so 15% either side of the weight that is estimated. So, you know, for example, the example I give in my book is you could have a baby that's estimated to be 8 pounds, for example. So that baby could be anything from like 6 pounds 13 to 9 pounds 3 ounces. If I've got
that's a huge range.
Right. So what we're saying is you can't actually tell how big a baby is before the baby's born.
And yet, where does this pressure of like your baby's measuring big, baby's going to keep getting big. Let's have an induction at 39 weeks, for example, because I'm starting to hear that a lot more. And then it's linked to, you know, the risks are brought up of risk of shoulder dystocia and risk of having, you know, perineal tears and big damage in the perineum and broken clavicles for the baby and, you know, oxygen deprivation that creates brain damage and all these really, really scary things based on your baby's seems big.
Yeah, everyone's terrified. I mean, as women will tell you when they're pregnant, you know, women find in the supermarkets, people come up and say, oh, you're really big. We're slightly obsessed with big babies. And I think ultrasonographers, even when they're not doing size ultrasounds, feel the need to say something. And often the thing that people say is about the size of the baby. And then we have care providers that reinforce that. And there's just a lot of fear. And I'm not sure where that comes from, because if we're talking about then inducing women because we think they have a big baby, which we don't know until the baby's out, so a suspected big baby, then yes, it will reduce the chance of shoulder dystocia because you're inducing, the baby will be smaller. You know, if you induce a woman at 39 weeks, then her baby will be smaller. So we're overall reducing the chance of shoulder dystocia from 6.8% to 4.1%. But what we're actually doing is increasing perineal tearing and increasing babies being treated by jaundice. So yes, shoulder dystocia can be reduced by inducing, but a whole load of other things click into place once you've gone down that path. So to be fair to women, we should be saying, okay, we can induce you. And you know, that's why I wrote the book about induction, is it's not just, it's an entirely different experience with an entirely different set of options and risks within that. And doing that will increase the risk of some things and decrease the risk of other things.
Mm-hmm. And also the fact that, you know, babies cook differently for each person.
Absolutely.
So if we look at the average due date or the average birth date for first-time moms, we find, our research finds that it's closer to 40 weeks, 6 days, mm-hmm. or almost 41 weeks. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think it's 43 for second and more time moms. But 40, so it's almost 41 weeks. Mm-hmm. And having a baby be induced, aside from how different the experience is, because you're trying to force labor, you're not really in labor until your body takes over. This 39 weeks, those 2 weeks, there's a lot of forming that can happen for the baby. So it's not, you might reduce the shoulder dystocia, but are you causing any problems, any respiratory problems, because the lungs, you know, are tend to be the last thing to form and such.
And also, really, we've got to bear in mind that the biggest risk factor is the suspicion of the size of the baby, not the size of the baby. So when researchers looked at what the outcomes are for suspected big babies, not actual big babies, so this is a group of women who were, because I think it's in America, 2 out of 3 women are told their babies are big. So, and in that group of women who were told, this is a piece of research that looked at a group of women, 2 out of 3 of them were told their babies were big, and out of that group, the average weight for the baby was 7 pounds 13. So this was not a group of women with big babies. And another study looked at what happens when a woman is suspected of carrying a big baby. And what they found was that her chance of induction and cesarean increases by threefold, and that her chance of complications, and by that they looked at severe perineal tearing and hemorrhage, it was 4 times a woman who was not suspected of having a big baby. So there is something going on with the way that care providers look after women when they think there's a big baby, even when there's not a big baby. So the risks associated with big babies are mostly about what the perception of a big baby does to the people who are looking after you.
Mm. And I've actually seen that in practice, because I've seen, you know, 10-pound babies that just surprised everybody, and nobody thought that baby was that size. It's like, oh, no problem at all. And I've seen suspected big babies of, you know, end up being 7 pounds. And I'm sure you have.
Absolutely.
You're familiar with this too.
I can remember looking after a woman who had been told her baby was huge, and it was her first baby. She was very anxious. This is in hospital. She was very anxious about it. And everybody was then all, you know, on alert. Make sure that you get the obstetrician when the baby's going to be born, because, you know, this baby's going to get stuck because it's so big, blah, blah, blah. So I was caring for this woman who was, you know, most of the care was around trying to de-escalate all the fear that was coming, you know, from around her, not, you know. And once she got into labor, labor's fantastic at that. It kind of just knocks out that neocortex and women kind of get on with it. And she actually started pushing her baby out in the toilet, perfect place to push your baby out in. So we carried on. And I don't know how, because I certainly didn't press any buttons or anything. But as this baby was crowning and coming out, I saw an obstetrician arrive and look into the toilet door and was absolutely furious and saying, we need to get this woman on the bed. And I said, well, the baby's coming out. And baby came out, and it, surprise, surprise, was about 7 pounds. You know, it wasn't huge. And all was good. And then afterwards, I got absolutely hauled over the coals about, you know, how, you know, having that baby in that environment, in the toilet, and couldn't have managed, you know, shoulder dystocia, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, hang on, the baby wasn't big. And that would probably be a really good place for the baby to not get stuck if it had been big. But, you know, the perception of her care, the perceptions of her and her birth were, you know, we needed to have her on the bed in a position that we could do things to her because the baby was going to get stuck.
Right. So let's take a quick break. But when we come back, let's look deeper into shoulder, like what happens, what if a shoulder dystocia occurs, and risk factors and ways to prevent it and all that. We'll be right back. Great news, mighty ones. Birthful listeners can get a whole month free trial at expectful.com, which is 2 more weeks of free meditation than their usual 2-week trial. If you've been meaning to try meditation, this is the perfect time to jump on this offer. Meditating is a great way to reset your nervous system and mindfully bring yourself back to calm. And this is really important because if your nervous system spends more time in high alert and doesn't get to go back to baseline often, then your body is in constant state of stress, which is not healthy. Meditating is a super easy way to make sure you break up those stress signals. The best part is that you don't have to sit for long hours to see the benefits. If you have 5 minutes, then you have time to meditate. And it becomes even easier when you use a meditation app like Expectful. I have tried other meditation apps, and I really like how the Expectful one is designed to address your pregnant or new parent needs by focusing on whatever you need at that moment. Whether it's better sleep, connection with baby and partner, embracing your identity, lessening stress, dealing with uncertainty, Expectful makes it super easy for you. And I gotta say, I really enjoy the voice of the person who reads the meditations. Go to expectful.com/birthful to sign up for a free 4-week trial and check it out for yourself. Yep, that's a free full month to try it out. And don't forget to add the /birthful so you can get that free full month. So that's expectful.com/birthful. And we are back talking with Rachel Reed about big babies and shoulder dystocia. So there's so much to this topic, so many intricacies that it's like we could spend hours, days talking about this, write books about it, which you have when related to induction. But does shoulder, like how often does shoulder dystocia occur?
Okay, so I actually looked at a span of all of the research, and the incidence is quoted in research, and it's from 0.2% to 14%. Depending on which research you look at. And that's probably down to definitions and what people call shoulder dystocia, how they report shoulder dystocia. So, you know, my hunch is that if it's a large baby, that it's reported more often. And you'll often hear midwives talk about sticky shoulders, you know. So some midwives will refer to a baby who needed a little bit of traction to come out as a sticky shoulders baby. Other ones won't even mention or notice it, and other ones would consider that a shoulder dystocia. So it's the actual precise rates are largely unknown because of the different interpretations of what exactly shoulder dystocia is.
Mm. And one thing that I found really interesting in while researching for this as well is that although big babies are at a higher risk for shoulder dystocia, at least half of all cases of shoulder dystocia happen in smaller or normal-sized babies.
Yes, because there's more smaller babies proportionately being born, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So
the absolute numbers, right, are about the same.
So as a care provider, you will be attending more births with normal-sized babies where there's shoulder dystocia than big babies.
So if shoulder dystocia happens, you know, in absolute numbers just as much for regular sized babies than for big babies. So in terms of actually being a provider that has to encounter that situation, it's really about the same. And we're not good at determining the baby size ahead of time. Mm-hmm. Why is it that this whole bit about, you know, consideration of it's really bad because shoulder dystocia could happen and you really should be induced or something happens, and having that fear placed in mom's head doesn't happen, or in the birthing person's head doesn't happen to everybody who's giving birth, since it really, like, if you look at the numbers, it is on the offset, not an onset, not knowing the size of your baby, it's kind of the same risk for everybody. We know that afterwards, if we measure the babies, then we see, oh yes, bigger babies tend to have higher risk, but we can't tell really the size of that baby ahead of time.
No, and that's because the way our concepts of risk are cultural, and certainly within in organizations, they have a particularly a way of looking at risk that is maybe not necessarily how an individual woman would look at her own risk. I mean, for example, with VBAC, as you know, there's all this drama around the risk of uterine rupture, which is, you know, less than 1%, 0.5%. And yet for those women, they're actually more likely to have a shoulder dystocia, but nobody talks to them about that. The focus for those women would be on the VBACs. So the way that we talk to women about risk reflects our cultural norms and what the priorities are, I guess, for the organisation. I think that's one really important thing for women, and that's why I actually wrote a section on perceptions of risk in my book, is that for women, they need to consider that the people who are talking to them and giving them numbers about risk are coming from a particular perspective, and that they need to really consider what their perspective is and what's important to them and interpret it in that way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's hard because they're not medical providers, but they need to know the information in order to make that decision. And it's hard to figure out, like, well, is this relating to me specifically, or is this more relating to the institution and policy?
Yeah,
and which is a tough call.
And also to ask for actual numbers, I think that's one strategy that can really help, because you'll often hear people say, oh, you've increased risk of, or, you know, threefold chance of. It's like, so what does that mean? You know, what is that in terms of what's the percentage or the number if I have this intervention versus if I don't, and to be able to compare actual numbers rather than, you know, these quite scary announcements about, you know, 50% more likely. Well, if it's 50% of 0.5, then it's not really that high.
Right. Yeah. Or it's gone from 0.2 to 0.4.
Mm, yeah.
That doubled. Right. Doubled. So all of these, this preamble, how scary is shoulder dystocia? Like, what if it does happen? What are some risk factors? Were there ways to avoid it? Like, how scary really is it?
Oh, again, it depends who you ask. So it seems to be very, very scary for care providers, which is interesting because there's a lot of other things that I consider far more risky that are not feared. For example, the use of syntocinon, that medication, is the biggest risk factor for a baby in labour in terms of, you know, law cases are settled out of court because it's just known. And yet care providers won't think twice about putting up Pitocin infusion. And yet we'll be extremely fearful of a shoulder dystocia when the vast majority of the time the baby is released, even in a very medical setting where there's lots of, you know, where they work through all of their set maneuvers. The baby is, you know, 90% of the babies are released with the first maneuver that we do, which is just positioning the woman if we're following the standard protocol. So it's actually it's a complication. It's not nice as a care provider to see it. It can be quite scary, but it's certainly not up there with, you know, other things that could happen. But care providers are very nervous about it.
Mm-hmm. And so are there ways to avoid it?
Yes, there are ways to avoid it.
What are some ways to avoid it, Rachel?
Well, I guess from the before the baby's born, you know, anything that keep normal blood glucose levels, so you're not creating a baby who is very, very large, not kind of genetically and normally large. Because I can't find this read. I can remember reading it and I can't find it, and I wish I could find it. There's research showing that women modulate and regulate the size of their babies themselves. So there's some, and we know that there's a lot going on between woman and baby in terms of modulating epigenetics. So for example, a woman who is carrying a child that's not genetically hers, you know, that's maybe from another woman's egg, will actually alter the epigenetics of that child. So we'll have some say in the way that that child grows, and that women grow babies that fit their pelvises. However, if a woman has high blood glucose levels, then that can be altered because the baby's physiology is changed because of those blood glucose levels. So I guess, you know, keeping, you know, healthy diet, that's pre-birth. And then in terms of birth, anything that interferes with instinctive birth is a risk. So that's quite a lot. You really, for looking at it from the other perspective, for the optimal, because the optimal chance of physiologically birthing a big baby, then we want an environment that supports the woman's instinct, where she's not disturbed, and where we're not interfering with the physiology that needs to take place for that baby to navigate through the pelvis.
Mm-hmm. And I want to talk a little bit about the undisturbed birth. When you mentioned in your blog post that you've seen some bizarre birth positions and movements that made perfect sense once the baby emerged. And I wonder if you would share with us a couple of those scenarios after the break. Let's take a break. We'll be right back. Breastfeeding, it may be natural, but that sure does not mean it's easy. It's a learning process for both you and baby, and like most learning processes, it takes a lot of trial and error. However, this trial and error can sometimes come with a lot of crying, and not necessarily only from your baby. Help lessen the crying and frustration by arming yourself with some solid knowledge. A great way to prepare for this is by taking the Simply Breastfeeding online class created by breastfeeding experts Cindy and Jana. In their class, you'll learn to recognize what your baby is telling you and how to meet your baby's needs starting in the very first hour after birth. You'll also understand the basics of breastfeeding and be able to return to them if you encounter difficulties, and you'll feel confident knowing the answers to most frequently asked questions. Lessen your anxiety and frustration and relax knowing you've got this. Go to birthful.com/simplybreastfeeding to learn more. And as a Birthful listener, you get 15% off if you use the code Birthful when you register. Go to birthful.com/simplybreastfeeding or click the link on the show notes to get you on your way. And we're back. So letting mom position, or letting birthing person position themselves freely in the way that their body is telling them instinctually is kind of like what happens when you actually let physiology unfold and don't disturb the dance that's happening with mom and baby, when, you know, by asking questions or saying move here, or, you know, get over there. Or what are some of these bizarre birth positions that you've seen that were like, oh, being on her head made total sense because the baby was like so and so?
Well, there actually is one with a woman on her head. So this is a woman who's having her third baby, and she had declined scans and was laboring at home, and, you know, laboring in the usual way. Actually, it was quite a stoppy start labor, in that it would start when her children went to bed and then would slow down once they woke up for a couple of days, and then, you know, took off and established. And then as she came to pushing, she was in the bathroom and she literally put her head on the floor and her bottom in the air. So she was actually upside down. And the midwives are watching this and we're looking at each other thinking, this is really odd. And, you know, because I'm a bit of a busybody inside, I try not to do that on the outside. I'm like, that's not going to help. You need to be upright, blah, 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 blah. But no, let's just keep quiet. I've actually learned to not say what's happening in my head a lot of the time. And she was pushing. You see this baby coming up and then sliding all the way back in again because she was upside down. And then as the baby's head was born, there was a gush of blood, which is unusual. You know, you wouldn't expect a woman having a third baby to tear. So thinking that probably isn't that. Anyway, the baby came out with the placenta, and needed a little bit of, you know, stimulation, just rubbing and encouraging to start breathing. And, you know, I think that placenta was very, very close to the cervix or across the cervix, and that she was taking the pressure off the placenta for that baby to be able to be born. So afterwards, that made sense.
Right, because she had declined scans, so you didn't know where the placenta was ahead of time.
No.
Right.
And in terms of managing a shoulder dystocia, while sometimes, you know, as a care provider, you do have to step in and do things, women can sort it out themselves a lot of the time if you just wait. I was at a big, this is a gestational diabetic mom who had again declined screening, didn't know she's gestational diabetic and hadn't been for her previous pregnancies. So this baby's head came out and she was at the other side of the room on all fours on her bed with her husband was going to catch the baby. So I was out of the way. And this baby's head came out and immediately knew, oh dear, that's huge and very red and big cheeks and just quite clearly, you know, a big gestational diabetic baby. And then the next contraction, nothing happened. This baby would kind of move forward and then jump back. It was, the shoulders were obviously not aligned well. And I was just about to, you know, rush over and do the hero thing with the cape. And, you know, mother sorted it out herself. She kind of put her leg forward and did this kind of Elvis pelvic thrust. And this baby flew out into dad's hands. So that really taught me a lot about just waiting so that you've got a little bit of time. And see what mum does. And, you know, she said, oh, yeah, felt like this baby was kind of lodged somewhere. And I just felt I needed to shift. So I've seen that a few times. And a mum shared her birth movie with me, the free birth that she had. And the same thing, this baby was actually stuck for a really long time, like a good few minutes, and contractions with no change. And then she eventually just moved her leg, changed the position of her pelvis, and this baby came out. So, you know, women can instinctively do that. I'm not saying we should never step in and assist, but just to remember in the background that sometimes if we keep out of the way, the woman will work it out. It's her body and it's her baby, and she can certainly feel what's going on better than we can.
Yes, it's happening inside, like this thing's inside you, right? Really? Yes. So because it's the baby being stuck on somewhere, the baby's shoulder being stuck somewhere in on mom's pelvis, then changing, you talked about changing that, she or the birthing person changing positions, moving left, lifting leg, rocking, thrusting Elvis style to change the position of the pelvis. And then what is there anything else that can be done to resolve a shoulder dystocia?
Well, when it's actually happening, you've got kind of, you either need to move the pelvis, change the, you know, shape or position of the pelvis. You need to move the baby's shoulders or change the shape and position of the baby's shoulders, or you need to do both of those things at the same time. And different techniques from an external perspective do different things. So that's why it's really helpful to have for care providers to have a really holistic understanding of what might be happening and how best to sort things out in this particular situation. Having said that, you know, the standard approach that care providers use, the mnemonic that they work through, will actually do all of those things at some point. They just work through a, you know, set standard. They first of all move the woman's pelvis and then they do various things. So I guess in terms of, you know, for example, if a woman's mobile and on all fours, then it's really easy to do. Gail Tully's got a system that she talks about, flip-flop. It's really easy to get the woman just to move her leg up and change the shape of her pelvis. If a woman's had an epidural and is flat on her back, then that's going to be a lot harder to do. So you might opt for a different management of that scenario. Mm. And in terms of the care provider helping, all of the space is in the back of the pelvis. So when we look at the shape of the pelvis, then the space is all in the back. And whether that's in order to get some fingers in just to rotate the baby's shoulder or for the woman to get into the position that makes the most of that space, then it's really helpful to whatever's happening, whether it's breech or shoulder dystocia or anything, the space is in the back of the pelvis, so really safeguarding that space, making sure that back of the pelvis is free to move.
Right. And so if you mentioned epidurals, if usually with an epidural, or if you're asking, or even without an epidural, if you're doing management pushing stage, there tends to be the idea that women should be lying on their backs and even reclining on, not completely flat, but reclining on their backs, that then actually puts counter pressure on that tailbone in the back of the pelvis, so I can't uncurl. I can't open that space.
Yeah, so you're actually increasing the chance of shoulder distortion and making it more difficult to manage.
By being on the back.
Yes.
Yes. I just want to make sure that is clearly understood.
I know. It doesn't make any sense, does it?
Now, what about this idea? I've heard many providers, midwives included, say, like when, and maybe it's because pushing starts too early, but, you know, when pushing is not progressing and it's not progressing, and it, mind you, it might be like there's a lip and I just moved it out of the way and now start pushing. That's why I'm thinking it might be too early to push. But in any case, pushing has begun and it's not progressing very much. And then they get this slowly guide the person to being on their back and almost really flat on their back and say, no, this is the best way for baby to, you know, get that head under the pubic bone. What is that about?
Oh, well, you would hope that women aren't pushing until the baby's head is under the pubic bone, because that's kind of counterintuitive. The baby needs to descend deeply enough to instigate spontaneous pushing. And actually, if you wait for physiological pushing to happen, it actually is fairly short space of time, because it doesn't happen until the baby's really deep in the pelvis and then the woman feels all of that pressure and the nerves are stimulated for that really instinctive pushing to happen. So, you know, one, don't be pushing cervical lips out of the way, because the baby might still need to do things before its head comes through the cervix. And directed pushing doesn't give the baby that opportunity to wriggle and move and change in between contractions. So you're more likely to end up with shoulder distortion if you're directing women to push, because you're directing them to push this baby onto the pelvis before it's had a chance to wriggle itself around, so its shoulder's not going to end up on the pelvis.
It's a forcing it to happen.
Yeah.
So
a lot of the things that seem to be routine practices, which are actually based on fairly recent, if we look historically, fairly recent idea that women should be on their backs to birth babies, actually sets up the chance of a complication, a shoulder distortion. You know, that's actually providing prime opportunity for it to happen. And then we get into these weird, you know, scenarios of women need to be on their backs on the bed so we can manage the complication that we're going to create by putting the woman on the bed on her back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and I think it's important for listeners to then understand that if during their labor they hear, oh no, this is the best way to get that head under the pubic bone, that that's maybe a red flag of this is happening too soon and how about I go pee?
Mm. And how about I wait until my body's pushing?
Well, and I like that go pee, because it's like, wait, you know what, I want to stop and I want to go, you know, like get out of this bed and out of the back, and like it gives them words to go like wait and then decide, but it creates like it gives space basically.
And then sitting on the toilet and emptying the bladder actually provides more room for the baby, because you've got an empty bladder and a great position for the baby to come through the pelvis.
I love that. Do you need to pee? Like, that's one of my doula tricks. Would you like to pee first?
Toilets are fabulous places. The number of babies who are born in toilets. So, somebody needs to do some research on that.
Right. Okay. So then, so getting under the pubic bone and have a lip to move out of the way. Maybe things happening too early. Now, the other thing that kind of, I don't know what to do about it. And when we get together, doulas, and we're talking more about this, we're like, you know, there's been progress made in the past, whatever, 5-10 years in terms of supporting more physiological processes, and cords are clamped later now. And people are starting to appreciate the need for moving and using different positions. But then as soon as that head is out, there's hands on that head and there's like pulling on these babies. What is that about? And how does that affect shoulder dystocia?
Well, change is very slow in the maternity services, but it does happen. You know, it's just very, very slow. You know, I think cord clamping, it takes a long time to undo all of these interventions that were implemented without evidence. And in order to undo them, we need lots of research and evidence to prove that it's okay to not do the thing that was implemented without evidence. And I think that's one of the things that's really not shifting much, and that's the pulling babies once their heads are out. I have seen a change in places where water births implemented, because it's very much hands-off. So then care providers get used to not touching and seeing babies come out without them touching. And I think that's the key, is that care providers are taught how to maneuver babies out. So in their training, they'll have, you know, torsos, plastic torsos of women, which go right back to the, you know, we used to have real torsos of women in the 1700s. And they're maneuvering these dolls out of a plastic, you know, part of a woman, which is not really what's happening in birth. But we're taught to do particular maneuvers that require the woman on her back, because, you know, you pull the baby, the woman's on her back, you pull the baby shoulder down and then up. And that's how they're taught. So it becomes like a, you know, making yourself a cup of tea. This is just the way that you do it. And that's the way you do it at every birth. So to then not do it is really quite challenging. And I know, as a care provider myself, having been taught, you know, once the baby's head's out, you then grasp the sides of the baby's head and pull the baby out. And, you know, doing water birth, we weren't doing that. And we just implemented. And I thought, oh, well, why are we doing it when the baby's on land? This is when I was a new midwife, and I thought, well, I'm going to not do it on land and see what happens. And it was really, and I had to give myself a little stage, you know, just don't pull for X amount of time. Okay, now when you're comfortable with that, now don't pull for this amount of time. And that, and then in the end, you guess what? You don't have to pull. The baby just comes out, which then reinforced to me it works. So then I felt safe doing it. And if care providers aren't being exposed to seeing babies come out without being pulled, then they pull. And there's also that it's still difficult to, that space between the baby's head and the rest of the baby can be quite anxiety provoking, because you know, you're going, is this baby going to come out? What state's the baby going to be in? I've got a really lovely film of a birth that I attended. I was the camera person for this film. And for the birth, and the mom's birthing this, and she's small, this woman, and this huge baby's head comes out. And I'm thinking, this baby's going to get stuck. We need, you know, she needs to open her legs. She needs to do all these things. And it was quite a long time till the next contraction. And she moved her leg instinctively, and this baby rotated and found its own way out. And, you know, I could, okay. But it's actually quite difficult to watch sometimes from a care provider's perspective. And I think that they just get in and do it. And students often tell me, well, I'm, you know, if I'm in a birth, I'm told to get your hands on that baby and get the baby out. So until that becomes the norm, and I almost see a move towards doing it more. In Australia, certainly, there's a real backlash to the kind of hands-off birth that a lot of midwives were starting to do. I don't know how we get, unless women actually write in their birth plans, do not, you know, I do not want you to touch my baby until the entire baby's out, or something that, you know, gives whoever their support people are, their doula, the power to say, look, this, the, remember, you know, as the baby's been born, oh, remember, she doesn't want you to touch the baby, or she wants to be the person to touch the baby, or someone, she wants her partner to be the person who touches the baby first.
Yeah. Well, and I was going to ask you, you know, what can parents do to try to lessen this? Because it can be, sometimes it can be rather forceful. And I'm sure that having like that early trigger to pull, especially if a baby, because they don't always rotate like you're taught at school, you know, sometimes they rotate a different way. Sometimes they don't rotate all the way and come out with the shoulders traverse. Sometimes, like, depending on, a hand comes out for it, like, babies they do their own thing, but can that pulling also then create a shoulder dystocia?
Oh yes, I mean, I haven't got any research to back this up, but if you think about the what's happening mechanically, if that baby hasn't rotated, if that baby's waiting for the next contraction in order to rotate its shoulders away from the symphysis pubis or away from the part of the pelvis that it's, you know, not lined up well with, and you stop pulling, then you're actually impacting that shoulder into the pelvis. And I also am convinced that a lot of the tearing that women get is from that pulling baby's shoulders downwards into their perineum. Because it's just interesting that when caring for women in hospital settings where they're primarily birthing on their back, then the tearing tends to be at the back of the vagina, just where the shoulder, and often you'll see the perineum intact as the baby's born, and then after the baby's been pulled out, they've got a tear at the back of their vagina, just where the shoulder would have been pulled into their tissue. Whereas when women are birthing outside of hospital setting, most of the women I attend have birthed, not all because they do their own thing, most though end up in a upright forward leaning position at the point that the baby's head's coming out. So any tearing seems to be, or labial grazes are the most common, you know, the pressure of the baby goes up a different way. So I think that this pulling on babies' heads is impacting shoulders into pelvises and, you know, causing trauma to women's perineums.
And then I think it's so important for people to really listen to this and know how much power they can have during that time with their own movement and with their own instinctual, you know, shaking the leg or doing whatever it is, like to actually listen to what their bodies are telling them, because they can, by tuning in, they can actually lessen damage.
Yeah.
Both to themselves and baby.
Generally speaking, instinctive physiological birth results in the best outcomes for mother and baby. That's kind of physiological birth, because I tend to not say natural birth, because natural birth includes pathology. You know, a pathology is natural. A shoulder dystocia is natural. Physiology is an organism functioning as it's, you know, in the optimal, healthy way, which is really, women's bodies have evolved to do this and can do it without intervention and without a pathology occurring most of the time. And yet we have a scenario where most women don't experience that, because the things we do to them are causing the complications and the pathology that then we need to manage. And just to ensure that women have that sense that I can do this, I have the instincts and everything that I need to birth this baby, and I also will know if I need help and if things are becoming complicated, and I can access that help, but I don't need it unless that happens.
Yeah, and one of the things also that was interesting to me was reading that shoulder dystocia itself is not a bad outcome. It's a bad outcome if there's an injury with it, which can be like a brachial plexus palsy, which is nerve damage, right, to the neck and shoulder, and hands can be involved in that nerve damage. But it was so interesting to me to read the numbers that 48 to 72% of brachial plexus palsy, so a large majority of it, happen without shoulder dystocia. And it can happen during cesarean, and it was completely eliminated in the UK when they did a training for providers. It was a prompt, I'll link it in the show notes, or just to the article, not to the training. The prompt training, which then it kind of pointed to these injuries were provider induced, basically, if a training for providers eliminated them.
Yeah. And part of that is, you know, the pulling a baby who's not ready to be pulled. You're actually compressing those nerves in the neck and through to the shoulder when you're pulling. So the baby might not be stuck, but you pulling and compressing those nerves is going to cause the injury.
Yeah. So that's a whole, I have many conversations with doulas about this whole pulling thing and like, does it really need to happen? So I'm thrilled to be talking to you about this, even though it's kind of related to shoulder dysostosia and big babies, but more universal than that. One last question I had for you in terms of shoulder dystocia and epidurals, because epidurals are so common, that when I was reading your work, you talked about when there's an epidural, you have to work more, like not the person giving birth necessarily, but like the whole team, and be more proactive.
Yes.
Tell me more about that, because birthing people need to know this.
Okay, so in my early career, having a woman with an epidural was a bit of a, okay, now I just need to kind of kick back, make sure all the obs are normal, keep an eye on all the kind of medical stuff, and we'll all just chill until the end. You know, the woman's not requiring a lot of emotional support anymore, etc. However, a woman who has had an epidural, you've now done a number of things to her body physiologically, which she might actually want. You know, she might have been in labor for hours now and just need to rest, you know, just need to actually relax for a bit before getting back into it. And that's great. But what an epidural does is relax the pelvic floor and the muscles in the pelvis that actually assist the baby to rotate, which can actually help. If you've got a woman who's very, very tense, that can actually help by relaxing. But what it does is takes away that pivot point for the baby as it comes through the pelvis to rotate into a, you know, a optimal position. So you're more likely to have a baby who is persistently OP, you know, back to back with mom, or a baby who has a shoulder dystocia because they haven't had that opportunity to rotate themselves around. So you've kind of increased the chance, and the mother's not instinctively birthing now. So her connection to what's happening in her body has been taken out. So as the care provider, you now have to do that. You have to do the movement, because otherwise you've got a completely stationary pelvis and a baby who hasn't got the muscles to help the baby to pivot and rotate, and you've got a baby who's continuing to be compressed and descending through the pelvis without gravity and without movement. So as a care provider or doula or birth support person, you really need to help that woman's pelvis move. And whether that's using you know, a towel or shawl or rebozo to kind of get the pelvis just rocking, if that's just getting the mom to change position, you know, going, okay, so the last half hour you've just been in that position, so let's roll you onto this side, let's roll you onto the other side. There are various ways of doing it, but it really is the care provider's responsibility to manage the medication that they've provided. And that involves providing the woman with what you've kind of taken out with that medication, which is movement, and helping the baby navigate through.
Mm-hmm. And also, and it kind of brings us.
And at the point of birthing the baby, you know, there is no excuse to just stick with the flat on your back or semi-reclined pushing with an epidural. A lot of women can squat. The beds come, you know, you can do all kinds of amazing things with the beds nowadays to get women upright for that pushing phase. And even lying on their side gives more space in the back of the pelvis than sitting on the back of the pelvis. So there are ways to work with epidurals that, you know, I think care providers need to take ownership of if we're going to be administering epidurals.
I love that recommendation. It makes total sense to me that even though, yeah, you have to still support physiology as much as you can and give back some of what you've taken away, for sure. Love it. Rachel, if people want to follow what you're doing, connect with you, or buy your book, because you have a fabulous book that came out last year called Why Inductions Matter, and people should read that too. So if they want to do that, how can they do it?
You can get the book from any places that you can get books from, so Amazon, Book Depository, wherever. And my blog is just Midwife Thinking, and I'm also on Facebook. I don't do lots of blogs. What I do is I tend to, for example, with shoulder dystocia, have a topic and then I'll come back and update that blog as more research comes out or as things change. So I kind of update blogs regularly, but I don't necessarily write brand new ones a lot, unless there's an issue that's really riling me, then I'll write something. So that's the best way to find me, really.
It's not the quantity, it's the quality, because it's super good quality, that blog. Midwife thinking. Love it. Rachel, thank you so very much for doing this today. Was there anything that we left out?
I don't think so, not from my perspective. But, you know, if there is, people can maybe message the Midwife Thinking Facebook. They can send me a message and ask.
Yes, keep the conversation going. Yeah. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Mighty ones, find the in-depth show notes for this episode at birthful.com, where you can also learn more about me, the show, Patreon member benefits, send me messages, and more. And if you want to hear more of my talk with Rachel, including our musings on the Arrive trial, breech vaginal births, the way protocols get established in the birthing system, the fact that babies aren't born with cord clamps, and nuggets like this one.
And I used to always say, so tell me about the, tell me what you've learned about the behavioral effects of oxytocin. And they just look at me and like I was mad. Oh, well, oxytocin makes the uterus contract. Yeah, but what else does it do? No idea. None.
Then you should join us over at the Birthful Patreon, where you'll get the extra audio content for this episode, along with access to ad-free episodes by becoming an official Birthful supporter. Find out more at patreon.com/birthful. And if what you want to do is get ready for life with a newborn, then go to birthfulcourses.com and sign up for my Thrive with Your Newborn online postpartum preparation classes. This episode was produced by me and made possible by you, those amazing Birthful Patreon supporters, including the wonderful Megan Othling, and the people at Expectful and Simply Breastfeeding. Go to expectful.com/birthful to get a free 1 month trial, and go to birthful.com/simplybreastfeeding and use the code birthful for 15% off their breastfeeding course. The title song for this podcast is Vive Ace by Kevin McLeod, and the sponsorship song is Hair Hockey Saloon by Chris Zabriskie. Find them both at freemusicarchive.org. Also, the Birthful Podcast is part of the Parents on Demand Network, a network of podcasts focused on parents. Download the free Parents on Demand app on Apple and Android for easy on-the-go listening. I'm Adriana Losada. Please join me next week when I'll be talking to a mighty parent as they share their amazing story here at the Birthful Podcast. Thanks so very much for listening. This episode is copyright 2019 by Adriana Losada.